Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. I go solo on the host side again today as my regular co-host, Rob Hunt, remains skiing over on the continent and hopefully having a good time and staying healthy and safe. But he will be back next week for our big show when we will have Rob Bleetstein on, which we're really excited about and hope you will all be able to join us then. But for today, we've got an excellent show. We're very excited about some fast-breaking cannabis news, which we're going to get to in just a minute. And then we're joined today by Ian Monat. He is the CEO and co-founder of Rhythm Sparkling Hemp Beverages. And we're going to be looking forward to talking with him for a few minutes about that, about some of his musical background. And then Ian has said that he will stick around and listen to the Grateful Dead show we're going to feature. And with that, Dan, why don't you hit us with the opening clip here, and we'll take it from there. Thank you, Dan. Might as well. And our show today is from April 6, 1982 at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. We will be circling back around to that in a few minutes, but Might as Well is such a great tune, and 1982 was such a great year to see the Dead. Spoiler alert, that was the year of my first show, but not for a few months later. But everything that we're going to show off today from this show, all the clips that we're going to play are all tunes that were just big and soaring in 1982 for the Grateful Dead. Might As Well was one. And this is just such a great show. It's a great recording. It's probably more cassette copies of this show floating around out there than almost anything else. You know, the Dead just sound fantastic. It's true 1982 form. And some of the other stuff we're going to get to for this show is really big. But Might As Well was being played all the time. Then it was a first set closer. For Jerry, it would often, you know, alternate nights with Deal when he was closing out the first set. We all love Might As Well. Somewhere in the late 80s, it kind of fell off the playlist a little bit, not so much in the 90s. But of course, it's the tale of their famous train trip through Canada in 1970, I believe, with Janis Joplin and the band and many, many others. And there's a movie that was made about it also. But it's a great tune. It's a Garcia Band original that he brought over to the Dead, and always a fun way to start the show. Indeed, never had such a good time as we do on this podcast, and let's go forward with it and have some fun. So on the marijuana side today, the biggest news out there is something that we've all seen coming for a long time. We all keep talking about, and then inevitably wind up going home disappointed. And that is that the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or MORE, M-O-R-E, which is House Resolution 3617, and has been out there for a while. We are finally ready to get the House to vote on it, and we are very excited about that. This will only be the second time that one of the Houses of Congress has voted on taking marijuana off of the controlled substance list. Previously was in 2020. The last time the House of Representatives voted and approved an earlier version of the MORE Act, 228-164, it was basically a party line vote. But of course, in 2020, when it got to the Senate, it had no hope of getting through. As we've talked about, the Senate has politicized itself to the point that even when Republicans and Democrats agree on the same thing, if the bill is proposed, sponsored by a Democrat, the Republicans don't want it to go through because they don't want the Democrats to get the credit and vice versa. So the vote that's coming up really any day now, we're expecting it to happen in the next few days here, will certainly be historic if the House of Representatives again votes to approve this act, and there's no reason to believe they won't, even if it's a party line vote. That should be sufficient for them to pass. But as we've seen with the House of Representatives on prior issues, they tend to put politics aside for the most part when it comes to cannabis. And the Colorado guys vote yes, and the Oregon and Washington guys all vote yes. And the people from states that have programs where they see the revenue that's being generated and the lack of the harm that everyone always talks about, wind up coming out and voting for it. So I think that there's a fairly comfortable feeling that this can get through the House of Representatives, but it just begs the question of whether it's going to go anywhere once it reaches the Senate. Given everything else that's going on in the world right now, I find it hard to believe that any senator up there is going to take too much time to push everything off to the side to raise a marijuana bill. And we can all see the Mitch McConnell ads coming back to haunt Charles Schumacher forever, while, you know, Ukrainians burned, Chuck Schumer baked, and, you know, just wanted to get his marijuana approved. And that was more important to him than anything else, notwithstanding the fact, Mitch, that a couple of weeks ago we had the clip from the Ukrainian refugee who had gotten to the Ukrainian-Polish border and was getting ready to cross over and was being interviewed by the international news team that was there, and all he wanted to talk about was thank God for legal marijuana, 420, tell everyone back in the States that we're loving it, and why not? You know, war is hell, but smoke them if you got them. So the MORE Act is there. It's coming along. We're going to watch this very, very carefully. We would certainly like to see something like this pass, because it will, in fact, remove marijuana from the controlled substance list, where it currently resides as a Schedule 1 controlled substance. Greatest hypocrisy in the history of the world. We've talked about it before, but just go type up marijuana, Schedule 1 hypocrisy, and settle in for a long night of very frustrating reading. But basically, this will allow states to set their own policies, as they've done now, but to actually go ahead and make it legal, right? We've also talked about the fact that nowhere in the United States right now is marijuana legal, not even in the states where they quote-unquote say it's legal. They're not really making it legal. What they're doing when they pass an adult use law or a medical patient law is they're carving out an exception in the existing law. Under these certain circumstances, and assuming you follow these exact circumstances, right, buy at the dispensary, drive it home in the packaging, don't smoke it where your neighbors can see you, blah, 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 then you're not violating the law as far as they're concerned. So this, on the other hand, would actually not just make it legal, but make it legal on the federal level, where even today, as we all know, it remains painfully illegal. And even though we can all freely go into our dispensaries and purchase what we want to purchase, we all have to do it with an understanding and appreciation that anytime the feds decide it's time for them to do something, they can come rushing into any state at any time and start arresting everybody for violations of federal law. The fact that no Democratic administration has done it is significant but not surprising. The fact that no Republican administration has done it is also significant and certainly a little bit more surprising. But for those of us that have had time to kind of really study the issues, I think we begin to get an understanding that just like people talk about marijuana being a third rail in terms of whoever wants to be the guy to support it and run that risk of the potential negative backlash, I think now it's the question is being flipped, and who's going to be the guy who's going to be brave enough to go in and say, we're reversing everything, the feds are coming to crash in, all you state programs are all going away, we're going back to the dark ages, and no more marijuana. And quite frankly, there's certainly politicians in this country who have given the opportunity to do so, might very well do. So we can't take any of it for granted, even though we have adult use in medical and in Illinois and lots of other states. But we will keep our eye on that and report more as it comes along. On the other side, we have a state that's now finally and for the first time really fully embracing its new marijuana status, and that's Las Vegas. Right, Nevada, we all know, is basically Las Vegas. A few people like to go to Reno, but otherwise, you know, it's a lot of sand. And I don't mean to diss on the state of Nevada as a whole, but I don't know many people who go visiting Nevada and don't wind up in Las Vegas. And Las Vegas being Sin City or whatever you want to call it, where anything and everything can happen, we can't escape the hypocrisy there that says you can go into the casinos and they'll push drinks down your throat all night. In some casinos, you can smoke cigarettes till you're hacking up more than you want to hack up. You still can't smoke marijuana. And not only can you not smoke it in the casinos, you can't smoke it in any hotel rooms in the city. And when you check in, they have you sign a form that's not even just a no smoking cigarettes, but expressly points out marijuana and talks about fines ranging from $250 to $500 if you smoke marijuana in your room. So this creates a huge problem, right? Because marijuana is trying to advertise itself to the canna tourist industry, all these people who get up and fly places because they can go there, have a good time, and buy their marijuana legally. So you can go to Las Vegas, you can have a good time, you can buy your marijuana legally, you just can't smoke it anywhere. You can't smoke it out on the street, that's illegal. You can't smoke it in your car, that's illegal. And you can't take it back to your hotel and smoke it, because if you do, you run the risk of getting fined $250 to $500. This doesn't mean that people don't do it. Many do, but they certainly do it with a risk, and nobody likes to operate this way. Well, thank you, Pro Hospitality Group. This is a hospitality entity that currently owns a 420 friendly hotel in the Phoenix area called the Clarendon Hotel and Spa. They have now gone and paid $11.9 million for the 64-room Artisan Hotel that's located just off of the Las Vegas Strip. They will make it, they will buy it, open it, and make it 420 friendly. And here's the scary part, when Nevada regulations permit. So when will that be? Who knows? There's still a big pushback by the alcohol industry in Nevada, the gaming industry in Nevada, and a lot of other people who just don't want to see marijuana come in for any one of a number of reasons. Now, if marijuana were made legal, that might solve a lot of problems for a lot of these groups. But nevertheless, they've got a good thing going in that town, and marijuana is the new kid on the block, and they're not going to make it easy. But you know, groups like Pro Hospitality Group that are willing to go in and spend their money, and if they've spent that kind of money to buy and renovate a hotel, I'd like to believe that they're going to have the right lobbyists around and the right people to help them as they go and they push to try and get state regulations to allow them to actually open up a 420-friendly hotel on the Strip area in Las Vegas. Now, consumption lounges in Nevada have already been approved. They were approved back in 2021, and the first ones are expected to open sometime later this year. We don't have definite dates on that yet, but that will certainly be nice when you will have a public consumption lounge in Las Vegas, and it'll be interesting to see if they put music or shows behind that or gambling or whatever, but just the fact that you'll have that opportunity so you can finally go there, buy the marijuana you want to get, and have a place to go use it. So look for that. And just for comparison, the hotel that the spa that Pro Hospitality has opened in the Phoenix area, the Clarendon, this is a facility that actually features its own in-house marijuana consumption lounge. And there are a certain number of rooms there that are designated and allowed to smoke marijuana. And for anyone who's ever traveled with marijuana and tried to sneak a few hits in the bathroom of your hotel room, hoping that the vent will suck the smell out before the maid gets there, you can appreciate the peace of mind of knowing that you can now actually pay to be in a room where they know what you're going to do and they don't care. So that's enough on the marijuana side for the moment. There's always good stuff going on, but we have such a great Grateful Dead show to talk about today and a wonderful guest that we're going to push that other stuff to the side, and we're going to jump in right now, and I am going to introduce you to our guest today, Ian Monat. As we said, Ian is the CEO and co-founder of Rhythm Sparkling Hemp Beverages. Ian, thank you so much for coming on the Deadhead Cannabis Show today.
Hey, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. You know, this show, we live up to both ends of our title, and, you know, on the cannabis side, we're always looking for people who are coming up with innovations and making new inroads and helping to bring cannabis to the masses in new and exciting ways. Tell us a little bit about Rhythm. You know, give us a little bit of background, what it is, how you guys got the idea, and what you're looking to do with it.
Yeah, you actually introduced us more than you know. The Clarendon Hotel in Phoenix is one of our accounts, and we've actually participated in a number of events on their property, and they're a great partner of ours. We're serving Rhythm at their New Year's Eve party this past year. But let me back up. So I'm Ian Monat, CEO and co-founder of Rhythm Sparkling Hemp Beverages. I'm calling in from the San Francisco Bay Area today. I'm calling from the East Bay in a city called Walnut Creek near Oakland, and I'm originally from this area also. And so I guess three tracks to know about me are one that I've been kind of a lifelong musician. I took up playing electric bass back in high school, which was, we'll just say, a long time ago. And then, you know, after college, I worked in, I guess, call it like the corporate world for you know, 15 years, mostly working for consumer packaged goods companies, worked for a few Fortune 500 companies, and since 2014, spent a lot of time in the beverage industry, mostly wine and spirits. And then the third track is like an entrepreneurial streak. I've started four companies. Rhythm is the fourth company, and so it's always the small business and growing brands from the you know, sketch on the back of a napkin to hopefully, you know, being a successful company is, you know, a passion of mine.
Well, that's excellent. Well, some of the best ideas in the world came on the back of a cocktail napkin. So, you know, that's always a great way to get it started. What's your background?
My background. So, from the working in the corporate world perspective, it's mostly marketing and sales and analytics.
Had you been involved in any cannabis-based products prior to Rhythm?
Not any cannabis-based products. So I was working in the wine and spirits industry in California in 2010 when recreational legalization happened, and everybody in the industry was like completely enthralled with what was happening with cannabis and the thought of cannabis beverages, which hadn't really started yet in any meaningful way on the THC side or the CBD side. And so I wanted to participate in the cannabis space somehow. And so I took my limited coding skills and created a cannabis jobs website called Cali Weed Jobs, and launched it in, I think it was mid-2018. And it got some traction. I started going to cannabis trade shows like NCIA and the first Wine and Weed Symposium and MJ BizCon. And so it started getting some traction, and it ended up being acquired by a cannabis digital marketing agency that for the most part does a lot of like cannabis-based programmatic advertising. And so they acquired the company, and I worked for them for a while and grew the site from like under the umbrella of that company. Then shortly before the pandemic in 2020, they started having some troubles, and I left the company at that point. And that's when I decided, you know, what's next. I have to try my hand at a cannabis beverage, because when I was out promoting the cannabis job site, I went to one particular trade show, which was called the Cannabis Drinks Expo in San Francisco. This was in July of 2019, and it was, you know, it was super cool. There were lots of really early stage cannabis beverage brands on the THC side and the CBD side. Brands like Rebel Coast and Proposition, and I even ran into some people I knew from the alcohol industry who were kind of sniffing around, and it just, you know, some of the companies just had packaging, and they were like, well, we're going to launch soon, but we wanted to, you know, be here, have a presence at the trade show. And so, so I realized, oh, you know, I could start now and still be early in the space.
Sure. Absolutely. Did I see, I know you said you have a background in wine and alcohol. Do you have sommelier training in wine?
I have a certification that's called the WSET Level 2. And it's basically equivalent to the Sommelier Level 1 in terms of the composition of the test that's involved.
Okay. So, I mean, you've already got like nose for this kind of thing from the alcohol side. Do you find that translates over for you very well on the cannabis side too?
It does in terms of how we like the flavors of our beverages and how we want the consumer to experience our beverages. So we our goal is for you to, when you try a Rhythm beverage that has, you know, 25 milligrams of CBD, that you don't taste any cannabis. We're not trying to lean into, like, say, some sort of diesel aroma or some terpene aroma. We do our best to mask it and then deliver on like trendy flavors like strawberry hibiscus and grapefruit rosemary that have multiple layers to them and have a really nice flavor and aroma and hit on like sweet and savory and floral and fruity. And so I think in terms of coming up with the flavors of the beverages, the wine and spirits training has definitely helped out.
Fantastic. Have you found that you've come up with some flavors that are, you know, more popular than others? Do you have some best-selling flavors?
Yeah, our bestseller is called Rhythm Energy, and it's a CBD infused energy drink. It's a grapefruit rosemary flavor, and it delivers 25 milligrams of broad spectrum CBD as well as 100 milligrams of organic caffeine from green tea. And so it's a coffee replacement. It's great in the morning. It's great as like for that 2 p.m. slump. It's caffeine without the jitters, without the coffee breath. And it works great as like a mocktail or a cocktail mixer too. A lot of people make like Palomas or Greyhounds with it.
Now, as a guy with experience, did you ever tend bar?
I did. I am a certified mixologist. There's a lot of dust on that mixology certificate, but I'm a certified mixologist as well. And so I attended bar. Gosh, it's a long time ago. I used to like sling margaritas at a Mexican restaurant in Southern California, and I bartended bar at a golf club up in Northern California that was like a heavy brunch situation, lots of Bloody Marys and screwdrivers and whatnot. And
sure. Well, do you get a chance to like, you know, try to come up with new flavors or new concoctions to, you know, to mix the CBD in with other flavors and stuff like that?
Yeah. Formulating is like one of my favorite parts of the job. And so I work on our new products. We have a new product coming out this summer that I don't want to spill the beans too much about. But it's got a real nice new flavor combination. It's going to be promoting relaxation, and I think it's going to be a big hit.
Wonderful. Well, we'll keep our eyes open for that too. And when it comes out, you'll let us know, and we'll have you back on, and you'll tell us all about that one. Do you sell different drinks that have different amounts of CBD in them, or is it always a consistent dosage?
It's a consistent dosage of CBD across the lineup of drinks, and we just recently refresh the Rhythm brand, and there were two components to that refresh. One is the label on the outside. We have new art on our labels, and we think it's much improved. Our logo is bigger, and we lean into the function of the beverage as opposed to the flavor. And then on the inside, we spent a lot of time reformulating the flavor and the dose of CBD. So when we launched Rhythm back in 2020, we had 15 milligrams of CBD in each can, and now we have 25. So we're happy to deliver 66% more CBD. And at the same time, when we launched that, we actually dropped the price, the shelf price of the cans from a $5.99 price to the consumer to $4.99. So we're really happy with the offering that we have now. It's the the most potent liquid that we've offered at the least expensive price.
Okay. Where can we buy it? Where is it sold?
We have about 200 points of distribution across the U.S., mostly focused in Northern California, Arizona, New York, and the Virgin Islands. But we ship to the lower 48 states, and so you could go to drinkrhythm.com and place an order, and we'll ship it out usually the next day.
Very nice. Now, with all those states that you named, do you actually have manufacturing facilities in all of those states, or do you just manufacture at one location?
No, that's one of the benefits of CBD versus THC is that with CBD, you're not restricted to the state that you manufacture in. And so we have one manufacturing location in Denver, and from there we can distribute to the other states.
Well, that's great. That's the best part about the 2018 Farm Bill is it doesn't just make hemp and all of its constituent cannabinoids legal and take it off of the controlled substance schedule to the extent it was ever on there in the first place. But what it does is it also says that no state can interfere with the interstate transportation and commerce of CBD-based products, right? States don't have to necessarily approve it for their state, but if you want to ship it across the country, as you point out, you can absolutely do that, and that's been great for a lot of people. It's all very exciting. You just have to stay the heck out of Idaho because they haven't gotten the message, and even though they have, they pretend like they haven't heard it, and they play by their own rules. So even if you have to drive a few extra miles out of the way, my experience teaches me, stay out of Idaho. Someday they'll come around. But
I've heard the same, yes.
Yeah, but just not yet. Now, are you guys have any idea of going into any other type of hemp-infused food product besides drinks and beverages?
Well, our expertise lies in beverages, and our supply chain distribution is really beverage-focused. And so I think we'll continue to stay in our lane in the hemp beverage lane. And so, we could get into different types of beverages that aren't necessarily ready to drink, like powders is something we're interested in because, shipping water across the country is not fun. and it's not cheap. And so that's something we're looking at. And then there's different parts of the plant that are interesting too. So like terpenes are not a part of Rhythm, sparkling waters, but they could be a part of, a line extension. And then we started to use some minor cannabinoids as well. In addition to CBD, we have a Rhythm Sleep beverage that uses CBN in addition to CBD.
Nice. Is your technology that you use to manufacture these drinks such that if you wanted to, you could also manufacture THC drinks and use marijuana instead of hemp?
Yeah. We have a deep partnership with our emulsion supplier, who is Virtosa out of Oakland, California, and their emulsions work virtually the same with CBD or THC, and so we could certainly pretty quickly swap in THC for the CBD if we wanted to. And so it's something that is not a near-term priority. I think there's a lot of blue ocean for us on the CBD side. There's plenty of states where we don't have accounts and distributors yet, and we see that all as opportunity for us. And so so THC could be on the horizon, but not in the near term.
Something I want to throw out there that I thought I heard in our show notes, and if I'm wrong, then obviously you'll let me know. Did you work at Google for a while?
I did, yeah.
And tell me about the chef you met when you worked at Google.
Yeah, he was a very special chef, not just any chef. So I had a short stint at Google. This is a long time ago, back in like 2003. So if I had stayed there now, I could have could buy my own island. So Google was one of the first Silicon Valley companies that offer free meal, every meal is free. You get breakfast there, you get lunch there, and you can get dinner there. And it kept you on the campus, right? So that was the main goal, is they wanted you to never go home. But they had a huge cafeteria, and it wasn't like they just had prepackaged sandwiches out there. They had freshly made gourmet lunches, breakfast and lunches, 5 days a week, and it was all led by Chef Charlie, who was the Grateful Dead's touring chef for many years during the the majority of their touring life.
So I bet he had a few good stories about them.
I got to meet him once. We didn't get to really hang uh-huh. and shoot the shit. But I got to shake his hand and not only was the food healthy and eclectic, and you could tell it was food with a cool vibe and cool ingredients. But then they piped in Grateful Dead music, in the cafeteria, every day. So they played Grateful Dead during lunch, 5 days a week. And so that was cool. And that was some of the most exposure to the Grateful Dead music that I had. Because I eat in the cafeteria every day and, listen to Grateful Dead for 30 minutes a day. So it was cool.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because you are a musician. Tell us a little bit about about your musical experience. I know you play electric bass. What kind of a band, what kind of a music, what kind of venues you playing in, or were you playing in?
Yeah, so I've played in many bands over the years. In high school, it started with, garage bands covering Metallica, and then went off to college. I studied business and recording arts at Chico State University up in Northern California. And so I was in, a hip hop rock band, like Limp Bizkit was sort of like a crossover between hip hop and rock. That was a little bit like what we were, and we opened up for Jason Mraz and one of the guitar player of that band, the drummer of that band ended up being kind of a famous musician. He plays bass now in a band called Jamestown Revival out of Austin, who's big in kind of the Americana genre. Then I moved back after college, moved back to the Bay Area, and started playing with a San Francisco based jam band. That's where we played at Sweetwater.
Up in Mill Valley.
We talked about a little bit about that before we hit press play, and it was a super cool experience. You could kind of feel the energy when you're in that venue.
Well, that's an interesting point, because my buddies and I really make a point of trying to get around and see shows in as many different, historical venues as we can, and now that you get Bob Weir traveling and touring on his own and Phil Lesh touring on his own, they finally gotten back to a size where they can go in and they can play places like the Chicago Theater here in Chicago. We go and we see them all the time, but to go out to the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York, was a really cool experience. And to see them at the Fillmore out in San Francisco was a really cool experience. And from the perspective of an audience member, I always look at it as wow, I could just imagine being in this room back in the day when the Dead were the people, and everybody was sitting there dancing. But, what is it like when you're the musician and, you're playing on the same stage that whether it's the Grateful Dead or any band, musical giants have played on some of these stages before, and now here's your band doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's we're doing the same thing, but it's a little different, and I'm sure there's there's a few more people in the audience when those guys were playing than when my old band was.
Now, did you guys play Grateful Dead covers?
I think we covered like one of the most, you know, like the more popular tunes, like the Casey Jones.
Sure.
And it was kind of a loose version of Casey Jones. When I moved to Phoenix shortly after that time period, and went to grad school, and when I was in Phoenix, I played in a reggae band called the Upstrokes, and we played around for a few years, and it was in that band where I played more Grateful Dead songs. We played Scarlet Begonias. We did kind of a reggae cover of Scarlet Begonias, a little reminiscent of the Sublime version of it. And so I kind of remember playing that a lot more. And then I had another Grateful Dead touch point in 2018. I had moved back to Northern California at that time and was working in the wine industry up in Napa Valley. And I seeked out some musicians to play with and connected with a guy named Jeff Stangy, who plays the Hammond organ. And Jeff is quite the deadhead, and he actually was a Grateful Dead roadie and tech for many years, and so we played his original music in the band, and I could tell that a lot of it was, you know, greatly influenced by the Grateful Dead.
Very cool. Okay, well, excellent. That's just good fun to be able to get out there and do it. You know, and it's a, my mom always told me when I was young, you learn to play an instrument because when you're an adult, you'll be happy you did. And we'd always say, yeah, see you later, and run outside to play more baseball. And now, of course, we're adults and we wish we could. So it's great that a guy like you can. And yeah, that's just fun to be able to go out and do that and, you know, jam away and take on a whole new appreciation for the music and everything like that. Well, thank you so much, Ian. This is all really fascinating stuff. And I'm, you know, glad you're able to join us and go over all of this. I'm going to swing over for a minute here to our featured Grateful Dead show of the day. Please feel free to hang out and, you know, pipe in your thoughts and comments as well as we go through this one. I don't know if this is a show you're familiar with or not, but if not, you should rush out and get it and listen to it a lot because as a bass player, I mean, I don't know if you're bass, like, you know, how much you've listened to Phil Lesh or, you know, how much, you know, you listen to his style. But, you know, in the Dead world, you know, songs are judged by the number of, you know, Phil bombs that he drops throughout the tunes. And, you know, in the early 80s, Phil was kind of finding a second wind. And he'd come out to some of these shows and he'd really, you know, dive into it. And it was just a year or two later when he walked himself back up to the microphone again and started singing and eventually got himself up to Box of Rain and all of that and a bunch of Dylan stuff that he plays. But he's great on all of this. And it's a fun show. The show is at the Spectrum in Philadelphia. For many years, the home of the Philadelphia Flyers NHL team and the Philadelphia 76ers NBA team. And the Dead, I think their first show there, I want to say, was they were part of a touring ensemble in 1969 that wound up playing there with part of a festival. And then they showed up again in the early 70s. But they actually wound up playing, and I was very surprised. They played at the Spectrum 53 times between 69 and 95. I saw them there in the spring of 84. And for some reason that spring, they did not play at the Spectrum. They did their shows at the Philly Civic Center, which was also a very, very cool place. A little bit smaller and, you know, in that respect. But I never got to see them at the Spectrum, and yet it seems like every show that I listened to from there was great. But they played the Spectrum 53 times, which makes it the venue they played the most of any venue outside of the Bay Area, which I was surprised and immediately ran to my computer and Googled Grateful Dead at Madison Square Garden, and it came in at 52. So that would, in fact, make the Spectrum at 53 their clear-cut home away from home when they get out to the East Coast. And you know, even at Madison's Garden, Square Garden, you know, they're up there with Interesting Company. I believe it's Fish, Billy Joel, Elton John, and the Grateful Dead in that order of most shows at Madison Square Garden all time. But for the Dead, it's the second most played shows outside of the Bay Area after the Philly Spectrum. So Really, really good stuff. It's a very interesting time, 1982, because not only I think are the Dead kind of finding a new second wind now with Brent Midland, who's really gotten comfortable with the group, but they were really kind of playing at a unique part in their history where they didn't have the burden of any new album or new songs. In fact, 1981 was the first year in the band's history with no new Jerry or Bob original tune. You know, they might have dropped in a couple of cover tunes along the way in 1981, but there was nothing. They weren't playing anything new from Jerry or Bobby, and by 1982, by the end of 1982, they were already debuting Day Job, West LA Fadeaway, Throwing Stones, Touch of Grey, and in the spring of 81, in the summer of 81, they released Reckoning and Dead Set, but those, you know, really weren't new tunes at all. Those were just happened to be two fantastic live recordings, one all acoustic and one electric, from their 20th anniversary or 15th anniversary runs at the Warfield in San Francisco and Radio City Music Hall in New York in the month of September and October in 1980. But this was a great time, you know, for the Dead. They there was a lot of room for them to play the stuff they wanted to play. And they did a really, really good job of it. We heard them might as well. And now I'm going to drop in for our next clip here. Give Dan a heads up so he can go get it ready. The highlight, I think, of this entire show is the Shakedown Street that opens the second set. It's a huge, gigantic Shakedown Street. Ian, you'll appreciate it. I can't remember if the part I pulled has all of the Phil bass bombs in there or not, but either way, it's got great sound, and it's a 13-minute version, and trying to pick out 45 seconds of 13 minutes is practically impossible. And when I was doing my notes, I had like every other minute written down as a launching off point when we could listen from. But I think that this part that we've got here really kind of encapsulates very nicely where Jerry was going and how hot this Shakedown Street is. So, Dan, if you could spin that for us, that would be great. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever heard that version or not, Ian, but you know, the whole tune outside of the lyrics is just that same kind of, you know, real free flow. It's like improvisational Dead at its best, and it's just really fun to listen to.
Yeah, no, I hadn't heard that, but it was a tasty jam for sure. It had kind of like a little minor sound to it, and no, it's that was fun to hear. Saw great choice. No, I didn't hear a bass bomb though.
No, we didn't catch. There's a couple of others. In fact, if the very, very beginning of it is so huge that I thought about going with that, but I like to get into that part where you can really hear Jerry, you know, noodling around, you know, kind of in the middle of. That's the jam between the second and third set of lyrics, and you know. I've seen him play Shakedown Street a number of times, and I've seen some, you know, really, really big explosive Shakedown Streets. But, you know, this was just one night when they were on and they were really hitting it. And it's so much fun to listen to. And of course, you know, for those of us old enough to remember, you know, it came out in the late 1970s. So it was part of the whole movement that at the time, at least, was dubbed Disco Dead. And I always thought that was kind of an unfair rap for Shakedown Street, because although it does kind of have a bump, bump, bump sound to it, which I suppose, you know, could be interpreted into disco if you really wanted to. It's a Grateful Dead rock and roll classic, and it's one of those tunes that, you know, in my opinion, really puts them up there on a pedestal. It's instantly recognizable, one of their songs, and I just have this fantasy that someday at a Fish concert, you know, right in the middle of everything, Trey Anastasio is just going to break out into that bump, 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 and the whole crowd's going to go wild, and you know, it'll just be amazing. But you know, we'll see if that ever happens. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to listen to. Did you guys ever play Shakedown Street?
Nope, didn't reach that far into the catalog. But you know, it's a cool tune for sure.
Yeah, it is, and always fun to listen to. It's great as a show opener. It's great as a second set opener. It just and I've seen it as both. And either way, it just really kind of grabs you right away and throws you right into the middle of a fun concert, or if, you know, gets your second set off on a good note. Well, being 1982, you know, they come right out of this Shakedown Street without missing a beat. They jump into the Bob Weir magnum opus of Lost Sailor Saint of Circumstance, a Bobby twofer that we got a lot in 82 and 83. And they're two really good tunes that were both off of Go to Heaven, I believe. You know, Bobby kind of took them, stuck them together one after the other, and the Lost Saint jam became a real staple of Seeing the Dead at that time. And they're both great songs, and they both have, you know, really good sections that we can listen to. But I just thought it would be fun to catch for a moment kind of the energy as they transition out of the Lost Sailor over into the Saint of Circumstance, and really kind of tune down from one and immediately ramp up on the other. And Dan, if you've got that that next clip for us, that would be great if you could run that now. Okay, that's it's great. It's a lot of fun to listen to, and you know, they just play that so well as you know, Bobby finishes up one, ramps into the other, and they really take off there.
Yeah, that was cool. It was like a slow driving feel to it, but yet uplifting with the vocals.
Yeah, you know, and right at the very beginning, we got, you know, one of those classic Bobby yelps or howls or whatever. He used to do that all the time. And, you know, on the one hand, it could definitely be a little bit annoying. On the other hand, hey, it was just Bobby being Bobby, and you know, and we would all accept that and just move on. And in fact, we'll get to another Bob Weir moment here in a second, because they eventually come out of that Saint of Circumstance and hit it really hard with a beautiful Terrapin Station that we're not going to listen to, but it's as good as any Terrapin we've heard before, and it's that same spirit and energy that they're playing with all night. Then we get a quick little drums in space. And now when they come out of the space, this is actually really funny, and it had just about stopped by this point. And this is one of the last shows, I think. I don't remember seeing it live myself. But when they would come back out on the stage after space in 1982 and early 1983, the savvy Deadheads knew to look at Bob Weir, because if around his neck he had a whistle, like a referee's whistle, that was a pretty good sign that they were going into trucking. And as they go into trucking, he pulls out that whistle and he just blasts it like a drum major. Tweet, tweet, da-da-do, da-da-do. However, you know, you would do it like at the beginning of a drum major march. And it's really almost ear-splitting. And a lot of Deadheads didn't like it just because it was so loud if he'd blast it right into the microphone. And the story is that somewhere after this show, a few months later, Phil, finally acting out the frustration of everybody, reached over and grabbed the whistle out of Bob's hands and just tore the strap off his neck, and that was the end of the whistle. And they went on and would play many more great truckins after that. But if you're listening to this show and you come out of the space, you'll hear Bobby blow that whistle, and you know, just be ready for it, because it'll come out faster than you know it. Then what they would do sometimes is they come out of the truckin' and they drop into the other one, but they only play the second verse. And while I love the first verse of the other one and I love the whole song, I always appreciated when they do that. It's like, well, we don't really know if we want to drop another tune in here or not, but yeah, we'll just, you know, we'll drop half a tune in here. And it's just about 3 minutes long, this version of the other one. But that's a great one too. And Ian, I'll just point out, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with the other one, but that's also another one that's famous for its Phil bass bombs throughout the, you know, maybe not this version quite so much because they're playing a scaled down version of it, but go find, you know, any good other one from the early 1970s and turn up your bass, and, you know, you'll be able to relate to that. And then into Morning Dew. And note, the entire second set is just one long run, the Shakedown Street into the Lost Sailor, into the Saint of Circumstance, into the Terrapin, into the drums, into the space, right back out of the space, into the truck, in the Morning Dew, The other one, Morning Dew, and then they close it with Sugar Magnolia. So really, from the minute they walk out on stage in the second set and hit that first note of Shakedown, you have a continuous stream of live music until almost 2 hours later, when they finally, you know, get to the end of Sugar Magnolia and walk off the stage before the encore. And I mean, I don't know, you know, as a live musician, if you can speak, you know, to the kind of endurance that you have to not just play that many songs, but literally just roll from one right into the next without taking a breath or anything.
Well, no one's got the endurance like the Dead or the Fish or, you know, these bands that are known for their long concerts where it can't be just them playing the whole time for the 3 or 4 hours or whatnot, without any other openers. From an endurance perspective, like staying calm and not tensing up is one of the big keys. The minute you tense up and you're pressing your fingers like hard onto the fretboard and to the point where, you know, there's tension or your fingers are like turning white, That's the beginning of the end right there. Staying relaxed is the key to lasting through a long set.
Now, one of the great, you know, mysteries about the Dead, and until we actually get one of them on the show and can ask him point blank, everybody has their own opinions, is, you know, how much of these set lists were thought out in advance, you know, and how much were not. And of course, you know, for any Deadhead, the classic, you know, Grateful Dead lore we all want to believe is that they're just making it up on the spot as they go along. That's probably not entirely true, you know, and certainly now in the newer versions of them, they have very well-published set lists that they, you know, show to everyone afterwards and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, kind of buying into that myth for a minute, I think this is one of the other things that really, certainly me and I assume a lot of other Deadheads to them, is, you know, we've talked about this with other guests, is the way that the performers all kind of have this musical conversation on stage. So as they're getting to the end of a song, by, you know, Jerry dropping a note or the drummer is hitting a certain beat, they all know right away what song they're going to go into, you know, and they can cycle around and actually get into that. You know, in your time playing live, you know, did you play enough with a group of guys where you were able to actually kind of get to that level of, you know, just knowing from their little musical cues where they were going and what they were thinking?
Sometimes, yeah, you have to be, you know, playing with a group for a while before you can start to read each other's minds like that. But you know, sometimes it's the crowd. Like if everybody's up dancing and you know, you have like a slow song coming up next, maybe you want to skip that one and keep everybody on the dance floor. those are the kind of, you know, that's what's happening in the minds of the musicians as they, you know, kind of figure out on the fly, you know, should they continue with the set list as planned or deviate from it?
Well, that's great to hear. I saw Elvis Costello years ago at the Hollywood Bowl, and it was a wonderful show, but he only played about 45 minutes, and he just came out and just boom, 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 buzzed through one song after the next. You know, he knew what he was doing. There was, you know, just sailed right through. And, you know, I guess that works if you're Elvis Costello, but, you know, I've always enjoyed, you know, that much more relaxed pace where, you know, they get to the end of a tune and they kind of noodle their way out of it and kind of figure what they're going to go into and then noodle their way back into that. And, you know, here when they finally get to the Morning Dew, 2/3 of the way through the show, it's just as huge as some of the others. We actually, my co-host Rob Hunt and I had a feature a few weeks ago where we just focused on the song Morning Dew. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not, or if you guys ever had a chance to play that, but that's just, you know, long, melodic, very beautiful. You know, Garcia kind of takes it and makes it his own with his voice, and he does a really great job with it here. And then they just kind of drop into Sugar Magnolia, which is, seems to just be like, you know, the good old party tune for them. And it was always a great song to play at the end of the night, because even though you were disappointed that the show was ending, you were having so much fun with Sugar Magnolia that you just didn't really care all that much, which I think was, you know, their way of helping you get out the door at the end of a night. But, you know, Sugar Magnolia is always a great way to wrap up a hot show. We always would like to have it at any time, but boy, if you can get them to tag it at the end of a show like this, then, you know, you've really got the complete package, and that really, really makes it a lot of fun. And then, you know, with an encore, again, more Bob Dylan influence for these guys, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which is the encore I heard at my first show a few months later. In 82, it was getting played quite a lot, not so much in later years, but every now and then they would drop it out there, but I always thought that that was a, of all their encores, you know, maybe that one and Broke Down Palace with the Fare You Well, Fare You Well, you know, it's all over now, Baby Blue, just seemed to be a very good message, and the way Jerry sang it was also kind of good and kind of getting everybody mellowed down. We had a group of friends, some of our friends out of New York, my good friend Larry Rader, who was a host on the show once, or a guest on the show with us once, and they had aptly renamed the tune, It's All Over Now, Find Your Shoes, because the Deadheads would all take their shoes off, throw them in a corner, and dance all night. But when you heard this tune, you knew that they were winding down and you were going to have to find those shoes before somebody else found them and walked off in them if you wanted to get it. So we're going to listen to a clip of that in just a minute on our way out. But before we do that, just recap again and make sure everybody has a chance to go out and find a way to listen to this 4682 Spectrum show, because it's just really so fantastic. I want to say thank you again to our very good host today, guest Ian Monat from Rhythm Sparkling Hemp Beverages. Ian, thank you so much. And one more time, please let our listeners know where they can find out more about you or your product.
Sure. The best way is to just go to our website, drinkrhythm.com. Rhythm can be a funny word to spell. It's R-H-Y-T-H-M. So drinkrhythm.com, and I'm going to set up a 20% off code for your listeners. So we'll call it Dead 20. How about that?
That's beautiful. Yeah. So Dead 20, fans, go for it.
Dead 20 for 20% off your first order at drinkrhythm.com, and then our Instagram. We love our Instagram, and we're at drinkrhythm. On Instagram, so it's a pretty straightforward ways to learn more or to get a hold of us.
Okay, and as our veteran listeners know, but for our new listeners, if you check out the show notes online on our webpage, you can get all of this information, all of the links that Ian just mentioned, and you can get in and get that 20% discount, and tell all your friends and family about it, and let's get a lot of this stuff sold too. It's all, you know, going for a good thing on the cannabis side, and always happy to help a guy like Ian out whenever we can. So again, Ian, thank you so much. When you get these new products out, please let us know. We'd love to have you back on and get some updates from you and hear what's going on. To the listeners, next week Rob Hunt is back from his skiing travels, and we are very excited because our guest next week is going to be Rob Bleetstein. Rob, as you know, is a member of the team over at the SiriusXM Grateful Dead station. Three times a day, Rob introduces whatever concerts they're playing that day. He has great access to concerts. He's got great knowledge of them. And he's going to help us break down one of his very favorite first shows, April 1978, from William and Mary College. So anyone who wants to do a little advanced homework and go listen to that show, that's fine. And if you do and you have the Dave's Pick, I can't remember what number it was, 23 or 24 maybe, you will note that on the liner notes, Mr. Bleetstein actually drafted them. So that's kind of cool when you get a guy who drafted the liner notes for a Grateful Dead release. And we will look forward to having Rob on our show with host Rob Hunt back. So we hope that you will all plan to join us again next week and tune in to listen to that show. Otherwise, have a great week. Stay safe. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly. And enjoy the Grateful Dead doing Bob Dylan on your way out the door. Dan? At your door and standing in the clothes that you once wore. Strike another match, go start anew, and it's all over now, baby blue. And it's all over now, baby blue. And it's all over now, baby blue. And it's all over now, baby blue.